case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the second case of the day, Sweet Company versus Sika Chemical Corp. Or Sika, I guess it would. I don't know if you want to call it Sika.
European. Sika.
Mr. Murphy?
May it please the court. My name is David Murphy. I am counsel for J.S. Sweet Company in this matter. It's our position that the district court erred when it entered summary judgment against Sweet Company, in effect reversing its two favorable rulings in favor of Sweet Company rendered less than 6 months earlier. It's our position that Sweet submitted competent, relevant, admissible evidence in support of each allegation in its complaint, and that the district court correctly ruled that factual disputes existed requiring trial when it entered its orders of January 8, 2001 and February 5, 2001, respectively. It's our position that anything submitted by Sika after those two dates did not in any way affect the findings or conclusions made by the district court in the first two rulings.
But Mr. Murphy, the problem with your brief and what you're saying now, maybe you're finally getting to it, but the district court in fact did reconsider those earlier rulings because the defendant had submitted Mr. McPhee's supplemental evidence, and in the ruling that was the district court's final ruling on the matter, the court concludes that the things that had concerned it earlier were in fact not a problem, that McPhee wasn't an expert, that the photographs were cumulative of other photographs. This report that you talk about turns out to be, you know, a one-page letter just kind of describing what he saw, and the judge concludes that there really isn't anything to this. And that's what you really need to focus on, not what the judge might have thought along the way before he had the McPhee deposition.
Your Honor, could I restate it perhaps this way? It's our position that the McPhee report is entirely, completely a red herring. What is important in this matter is the Sweet file, which the corporate counsel for Sweet, or for Sika, said he had on his desk in November of 1996,
right,
which disappeared.
I understand that, but I guess what boggles my mind about your argument is the notion that every manufacturer who sells products to intermediate distributors, and then those products are then bought by other people down the chain, as far as I can tell, on your view, has a duty to keep every file they have in perpetuity. I don't know what triggered any particular need or notice that this was, I mean, they're a third party after all. They're not involved in your litigation with the Bridge Commission.
If I might, Your Honor, I'll address that point. The material in question was produced by Sika and sold through a third party or a supplier.
Sure, that's very common.
It was a particular kind of concrete patch, and it was a particular kind of epoxy overlay, and they worked together as a system.
Right.
In May of 1995, the epoxy was delaminating from the surface of the bridge below on the patch that Sika produced.
Right, and if somebody had sued Sika at that point for product liability or for contractual damages or something, you know, any theory you can think of, naturally it can't throw away the evidence. But nobody sued Sika then.
The Indiana Supreme Court in Webb v. Jarvis defined the concept of duty in a way that was picked up by Thompson versus Owensby and specifically said that when parties are in a certain kind of special relationship.
What's
and
the
harm,
special relationship here? It's not at all like Thompson.
Well, if I could, Your Honor, from that point on, from May of 1995 until the end of 1995, the customer purchaser supplier relationship ripened into that of a Sika approved contractor who was held out to the world by the terms of the agreement to be capable in the use of the material supplied by Sika. And when the dispute arose, what happened was the Bridge Commission said, you, Mr. Contractor, you have committed contractor malfeasance. It's your fault that this stuff is delaminating from the bridge surface. And Sika knew. They had a file. They had an investigation. And their man on the scene, Mr. McPhee, in his first deposition said, there was a failure of the system. The epoxy was a bond, debonding from the patch. He didn't say it was debonding from the old concrete. It was coming off of the new concrete. So at that point in time, SECA knew they had a serious problem with the materials they had supplied. And all they had to do was come forward and honor the terms of their agreement and say to Sweet, we can fix this for you. We'll supply new material.
Explain to me how the delamination was part of... It's certainly not Sweet's claim against the Bridge Commission, which is a mechanics lien foreclosure.
There was a counterclaim, Your Honor.
But what does the counterclaim say?
The counterclaim said that Sweet committed contractor malfeasance by failing to install it at a proper temperature, at a proper thickness, and under certain other conditions.
And what does that have to do with
it dragged
what you're
the litigation on for 4 years. Instead of going to mediation early or summary judgment early with the assistance of SECA's in-house investigation, which showed the cause of the failure, we were required to go into 4 years of litigation, go to the Indiana Court of Appeals, and come back and eventually win.
Yeah, right.
But in the process, instead of getting $160,000 of our attorney fees, we were awarded $90,000. And instead of being able to go about our business as a contractor and doing other jobs, we're sucked into this hole where we are consumed by this litigation, which was not our fault. The material failed.
You know, my mind boggles at the thought of any litigation, even the Enron case or something, taking 40 hours a week of the time of every single person associated with the company for years, for 4 years. That's a lot of time.
Part of the problem, Your Honor, is it's a small family-owned corporation.
I understand that.
And they all work together on the projects, both in the office and out of the office, so they all assist one another in all of these duties. The other problem was they're located east of Indianapolis, about 45 miles. The project was on the Illinois-Indiana border, just north of Poseyville at New Harmony. And the back and forth, the investigation, et cetera, literally consumed them. But it was all unnecessary in our view. And Judge Young said it was unnecessary in his first ruling. Could I please direct your attention to page 4 of Judge Young's decision of May the 30th? In the middle of the page, when he talks about the evidence being withheld, he makes a statement that, frankly, is just factually wrong and in complete contradiction to his earlier ruling. He says, there is no other evidence before the court that SECA ever generated any documents whatsoever in the course of their steps to figure out what was going on. That is completely in opposition to his ruling of January the 8th, 2001, on pages 4 through 7, where he described what it was they did. Now, the only conclusion, Your Honor, in all due respect, is there must have been a weighing of evidence and a determination of who to believe. And in our view, with all due respect, that's not proper in a summary judgment setting. That's for the trial court to determine, the jury to weigh the evidence and determine credibility.
Do you want to reserve some time for...
I would, sir, if I could,
right.
Please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Malley?
Your Honors, counsel, may it please the court. My name is John Maley, counsel for SECA Corporation, respectfully requesting that this court affirm the judgment below, which entered summary judgment on the contract and tort claims that were raised by the Sweets in this case. This is a case in which, on the spoliation claim, some additional facts are noteworthy.
You mean the spoliation claim?
Spoliation claim, that's correct, Your Honor. If I mispronounce it, I apologize. Sometimes Indiana spells it both ways.
Spoilation is what happens to fruit if you leave it out too long.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you. The situation, that if the court notes the Indiana appellate decision, in the Posey County Bridge litigation, the trial court found and the Court of Appeals affirmed that the problem with this bridge was that the SECA product that Sweets used had not been stored at specified temperatures. That was admitted of record by one of the Sweets. That was affirmed. That fact was affirmed. So that was the start of the problem. This was apparently a winter application that occurred in southern Indiana with this product that specifications say you need to keep it warm. This is sort of a molasses-y type of goop that mixes in with epoxy and helps extend the life of an
overhead. I take it that goop is the technical engineering term.
That's correct, yeah. As a non-engineer, that's the best I can do, Your Honor. But this product, then, to the extent that there was a problem with the bridge, the Posey County, the Bridge Commission litigation, the only issue at all was things like flagmen. They asked for extra time for additional flagmen. They wanted the project to be treated, the Bridge Commission, to be a public entity rather than a private entity so that the Indiana Mechanics Lien statute applied. Very interesting contractual Indiana law issues that had nothing to do with CECA and its product.
Could I ask you, Mr. Malley, whether you're familiar with the case now pending before the Indiana Supreme Court, Gribben versus Walmart?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you think that case is likely to throw light pertinent to this case on Indiana's tort of spoliation of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. The Indiana Supreme Court has accepted transfer, apparently, in this Walmart case, which is a first-party case where plaintiff sues defendant. Defendant does not retain something, and the question is, do we use the adverse inference rule, which is common in Indiana procedure and in much of federal procedure, or is there a separate first-party tort? California addressed that in the Mount Sinai case and first said, we're not going to recognize first-party spoliation, and then later in the Temple Hospital case said, for similar reasons, we're not going to recognize third-party spoliation. There's nothing, from what I know of that case, that would shed light on this case, unless it would, in fact, even make this case easier if the Supreme Court said we're not going to recognize first-party spoliation. But even if they were to do that, Judge Young correctly held that there's nothing about this case that any evidence that CECA did not preserve in whatever fashion, without regulatory requirements or some court requirements they were somehow supposed to know to hold, that would have impacted the bridge litigation. Why is that, Your Honors? It's because on May 23, 1995, when Frazier McPhee, a high school educated salesman, walked on that bridge, any of us could have walked on the bridge. We could have seen the same things that he saw. The suites were regularly on that bridge. They were on that bridge in July of 95. There's no evidence that the bridge had changed. The architect engineer, Armstrong, was Mike Magner, was with Mr. McPhee the same day he was on the bridge. He took photographs as well. Plaintiffs have those photographs. So this, when you look around the country at the spoliation case law, to the extent that the minority of courts have ever recognized the tort, they've noted that if the evidence is equally available, that there should, of course, be some self-help imposed on the plaintiffs in these cases. They were there. They had the evidence. There's no indication from what anyone could have seen on that bridge that day and the nature of the Bridge Commission litigation that would have ever changed the outcome of that litigation. And, in fact, as Your Honor noted, they essentially won that case. Apparently, the only disagreement was, well, they didn't recover all the fees that they desired and some particular hours for flagmen. So the case is easily decided and affirmed on that basis that the evidence was equally available and would not have impacted the outcome. To then ask this court and the federal court sitting in diversity to create new Indiana law when the state of Indiana has only in one case, an insurer context, where a six-year-old child was mauled by a dog, the dog was held by a restraining cable that malfunctioned somehow. The homeowner and then the insurer had the cable. Plaintiff, the child, sued the landowner and the cable manufacturer. The insurer had the cable and did not preserve it. Indiana, in that Thompson case, Court of Appeals said, there's a special duty by insurers. And when you're investigating as an insurer, you have to retain that evidence. It has not even been extended in Indiana to the employer-employee context, as in Murphy, where the court said no. The employer does not have an obligation to preserve evidence for your potential future products claim. So this court, as it always says in sitting diversity, is not one to reach out and be expansive and liberal in creating new state law for any of the states, and certainly this case would not cry out for an expansion of law. On the contract claims, which have not been orally argued today, but in terms of those issues, the district court correctly held that first, Indiana law, like most states, requires damages, evidence and proof of damages to recover on contract claims, unlike a battery claim where nominal damages might be presumed. And secondly, that there was no evidence of record offered by the plaintiff that there was any damage from this $250 CECA-approved contract to the extent that there was any question of fact as to breach. Finally, Your Honors, there's also then on the tort claims, if the court were to reach the issue, a question of time barred. Indiana has a two-year limitations period. You must initiate a tort action within 2 years of knowing or through ordinary diligence where you should have known of the claim. In 1995, of course, plaintiffs knew of SEEK. In fact, they knew of SEEK long before that. One of the suites, the record is clear, actually used to sell as an independent representative for SEEK. They have purchased SEEK product for years and years. By the way, after this bridge problem, they continued to buy SEEK product, which is indicating that they knew that it wasn't the SEEK product. But in any event, in 1996, by counsel's argument and by the record, they knew that there was some file relating to the suites. They knew they were in litigation. A simple trial rule 34C non-party request for production of documents, as the Indiana courts have held, puts the third party on notice. Hey, you may have something we want. Preserve it and produce it. And then all these individuals, ultimately six employees of SECA, were deposed in the Armstrong litigation. They simply did not depose them early enough, and they did not initiate an action soon enough. So for all these reasons, Your Honors, we respect the request that the judgment below be affirmed. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Malley. Mr. Murphy?
Yes.
I might, Your Honor. I'd like to reply, first of all, to Mr. Maley's arguments. As you will determine from reading the appellate decision in the state court mechanics lien foreclosure action, my clients prevailed on the counterclaim. So all of that argument about being misapplied or being too thick simply has no relevance. The Indiana trial court and the Court of Appeals rejected that as a basis for the counterclaim. The problem was it took 5 years to get the job done, almost 5 years. During that period of time, SECA, by its own admissions and through the materials we have shown to the trial court, knew the cause of the problem. Frazier McPhee, in his deposition in 1998, said there's a failure of the system. Why is this debonding? And in his deposition, he said, I sent this up the chain of command and asked for guidance. The other officers for SECA who testified, Mr. Dim, Mr. Roby, all talked about an internal evaluation process SECA went through to try and figure out what was wrong if there was a complaint, because they wanted to know and make corrections. And it's our position, when Mr. Cefele, corporate counsel, said, I've got the suite file on my desk, there was more in that folder than Frazier McPhee's site visit report. Mr. Cefele did not say, I've got Frazier's report, I've got the McPhee report. He said, I've got the suite file. Now, if I could segue from that to the statute of limitations argument, Your Honor, as we've shown in the brief, and the record is clear, SECA agreed to provide a witness at the state court trial, and the night before he was to testify, he backed out. He didn't appear. Later, and the timeline, again, is significant, later, Mr. Cefele acknowledged that he had the materials. There's no reason to believe that SECA has destroyed anything. We believe they still have those materials. It isn't until we send a subpoena that they say, 2 years later, oh, we don't have those materials, we don't know where they are, we can't explain what happened to them, but they're gone. Within 2 years of that date, my clients filed their action in the district court in accordance with the Indiana rule, the Indiana statute requiring tort claims to be filed within 2 years. Also, I think Mr. Maley may have overstated the case. The Indiana Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals have ruled several times since the Thompson case that Indiana recognizes a spoliation of evidence theory if it is based on destruction, alteration, concealment of physical evidence, not testimonial evidence. I submitted to the court on Monday by letter to the clerk three additional authorities, and the one that comes to mind that's most like our case here is called Porter versus Irvin's Interstate Brick and Block. Drive shaft falls out of a truck. Car behind runs over. Passengers killed. Expert for plaintiff asks where are the parts you took out before you put the new drive shaft in. Defendant says, we didn't keep those. We can't find them. Opinion is rendered by an expert for the plaintiff that says, this is what should have happened, this is probably what happened, but I didn't see the parts, so I can't tell you if, in fact, that happened. Summary judgment for the defendant, trial court level, it's reversed on appeal. And in the language, that the Court of Appeals uses talking about spoliation. It says, in Indiana, the exclusive possession of facts or evidence by a party coupled with the suppression of facts or evidence by that party may result in inference that the production of the evidence would be against the interest of the party. And it goes on to describe why Indiana recognizes that rule of law. My clients are not asking you to create new law. They're not asking you to do something that is not already in the Indiana jurisprudence. We're merely asking you to enforce the rules of law which the Indiana Supreme Court and the Indiana Court of Appeals has established. When you take the four rulings and you lay them side by side, the first two, which deny the motion for summary judgment on spoliation and deny the summary judgment on breach of contract, and compare them with the second two, there is a fundamental stylistic difference. The first two are written in the style of what are the facts on both sides on a material issue? 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. The second two decisions are written as though a trial has occurred. They are written in the style of a finder of fact after hearing all the evidence, a court trial, if you will. They are substantially different for that reason alone. We can find nothing, nothing at all in the record after the entry of Judge Young's first two rulings, which justifies his entry of the second two rulings. Now, I've covered a lot of these details in the briefs, and I don't want to bore you with more of that, Your Honor, but if there's something I could answer, if there's a question you have, I'd be happy to do that.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.